Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. You are listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr, sitting in for Carrie Miller. If you've been feeling a little post-Olympic letdown, we have a salve to let you down a little more easily. Carol Evans' Dave Schwartz is with us this morning to share his experiences in Rio. We'd like to hear your thoughts and questions for Dave, too. What will you remember about the Rio Olympics? What did you dislike? Call 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Or you can go to our live blog, nprnews.org/live. And then later in the hour, we will switch and talk a little more sports to talk about the U.S. Bank Stadium. We've now had four major events at the new stadium, including yesterday's preseason Vikings game. We want to hear your thoughts and questions about the fan experience. But first, we're going to go down to Brazil, to Rio, to actually talk about a new story that is developing there, and that is the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff, who is facing some real problems today. Joining us on the line is Stephanie Nolan, the South America Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. I understand today, Stephanie, a very busy day for you.
It is. The President Rousseff is testifying as we speak in the Senate. She just concluded a very emotional and impassioned half-hour address to senators, pleading with them to vote the right way and be remembered well by history, although I don't think anyone thinks she'll actually have succeeded in changing any minds. And now she's taking questions from the floor.
So she's not actually been accused of corruption. She's been accused of mismanagement. What is it that she's facing here?
Well, I guess that's one of the great ironies of this process is that President Rousseff, although Brazil is in the grips of a massive political or corruption scandal that involves many members of her government as well as the opposition, she herself has never been accused of financial wrongdoing. And so she, whereas the people voting, more than 60% of the people who will vote on her impeachment today are themselves either charged or under investigation for corruption. So her supporters certainly see that as a bit ironic. She's accused of what they call here financial juggling. She's accused of when her government was in facing a bad budget for its shortfall, borrowing from state banks to cover over holes in the accounts. She essentially doesn't deny having done it, but she says that every previous president before her did it and nobody had a problem with her doing it. And I'll spare you, but she has lots of other fairly arcane bureaucratic defenses for what she did wrong. It does certainly seem as if, you know, if there hadn't been other motives to try and take her down, I don't think anybody would be worrying too much about what she did.
Well, she has basically accused her detractors of essentially forcing a coup, committing a coup. I mean, is there any validity to that claim?
Well, I mean, I think that the fact that Ms. Rousseff and her supporters have used the language of coup has kind of muddied the waters here because, of course, Brazil did have a military coup, and in fact, Ms. Rousseff herself was a guerrilla who fought it in the pro-democracy underground for some time, something she talked about today, her experience of torture when she was caught by the dictatorship. So this isn't a coup in the sense of the overt subversion of democratic institutions. It is, she talked about just about half an hour ago, about how because she refused to stop the investigation into that giant corruption scandal that I mentioned a minute ago, the people in its targets set out to try and get rid of her. And that she has been making that argument for some time now. After she was first forced out of office in May and put on this very long impeachment trial, audio recordings came to light in which the people who have spearheaded this drive to remove her were recorded overtly saying just that, that this corruption investigation had to be shut down. So, you know, this country is so polarized at this point that she won't have convinced anybody, but there is, in fact, at this point, evidence that the people trying to get rid of her are trying to do so because they're bitter that she didn't protect them or because they want to make sure her government is gone so that if they're not yet indicted, they won't be.
So then I suppose the question, what happens as expected, she is pushed out today. Where does that leave Brazil?
Well, it's interesting, you know, in the kind of intervening 3 or 4 months, and obviously the Olympics kind of happened in the middle of that as a kind of giant national analgesic. There was really, you know, it was a very emotional moment when she was first forced out of office in May, and the people who supported her were vehement about how they would make sure that she wasn't actually impeached. But people have, in the intervening months, got quite accustomed to the interim president who, in fact, worked very hard to get her out of office and take the job. But now that he's there, although his popularity figures have never risen above 12%, people seemed, I think, fundamentally, Brazilians were so exhausted by these months and months and months of turmoil and drama that a few months of quiet has been appreciated even by Ms. Rousseff's supporters. And so if she loses this vote, that'll probably happen in the wee hours this evening, tomorrow morning, if she loses, and it's almost certain that she will, then Temer becomes president and serves out the rest of her mandate, which will be another 18 months or so. And the hope from a great many Brazilians, I think even those who don't believe the process against Rousseff has been fair, is that the official end of the turmoil will help the economic recovery plan really begin. I think that's maybe a really optimistic vision, because Temer is still going to face huge opposition trying to pass an austerity package, which is what the markets are demanding. So I don't think economically Brazil's out of the woods, but politically it looks at least like it or not, this particular chapter is closing today or tomorrow.
Let me pivot, if I may. The eyes of the world were on Rio for the Olympics, and now many eyes will return to Rio for the Paralympics, which are due to begin in just a few days. But on August 19th, organizers announced that they announced major cuts because of a precarious financial state, reports of poor ticket sales and concerns that athletes from as many as 10 countries may not be able to attend the Games because promised financial support is already overdue and may not be coming. How did we get to this point? I mean, sure, after the success of the London Paralympics, this all seems a little strange.
Yeah, so that's a great question. How did we get to this point? And let me tell you, nobody has provided anything resembling an answer at this point. The Rio 2016, the local organizing committee, seemed to think that they could just kind of come out and announce that they had a little tiny financial problem and needed a little bit of help to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, and that nobody would really kind of blink twice. They are not required to be transparent about their bookkeeping. So, you know, the same body stages the Olympics and the Paralympics, and they're answering no questions about where that money went or exactly how big their deficit is, exactly how much money they in fact need, and what they need it for. They've gone to the federal and the municipal governments of Rio and asked for hundreds of millions of dollars in bailout without saying how we got here, where did the money go, and why. The dominant theory here is that it was spent on emergencies trying at the last minute to get ready for the Olympics. Obviously, you know, in the climate of almost every major political figure and certainly every construction firm in the country and every infrastructure company, including all of them that worked on Rio 2016, being embroiled in this corruption scandal, there is certainly speculation about that being where that money went. The organizers, like you said, have announced some cuts. So they're scaling back on venues. They're scaling back on the media centers, the amount of seats that will be open in the stadiums. Those are the cuts they've announced. When I speak off the record with people who work for the company, they tell me that it's, in fact, much more sweeping, that they've been told that there's cuts in transportation, in the facilities for athletes, in broadcast, that all these things are going to be dramatic. Pared back. Again, there's no requirement on them to be transparent, so my fear is that we're not even going to know until it starts kind of just how bad it's going to be. Ticket sales are the one kind of shred of good news. They've picked up slightly. They were at 12% on August 19th, and now they're up at about 20%, partly, I think, in response, you know, out of a sense of shame at this announcement that the Paralympics were in such bad shape. Brazilians have started buying tickets a bit more industriously. But, you know, I think the reality is that they were never going to be the kinds of games that we saw in London, but it was nevertheless quite a rude shock to people here that they were shaping up, in fact, potentially still are shaping up to be a disaster.
Well, it says something that when you are announcing that you got 20% of ticket sales, that's seen as good news for
an
event.
Yeah, that was a big breakthrough.
An event that is opening
a week before
just
the
few
games.
Well, Stephanie Nolan, South America Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail, thank you very much for breaking away from a very busy day to talk to us today.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. You are listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr, sitting in the studio with Dave Schwartz, who is here from Care 11. Dave, thanks very much for joining us today.
Good morning. Great to be here.
So you are fresh from Rio. You look fully recovered. from
thanks
chasing
to a very little time difference. That's a big help.
So you were just down there. What was your sense just looking at the upcoming Paralympic Games? Were you aware of any evidence that there were problems or what was going on?
You know, she used the word scaled back, and I think you did see that. And I only have one games to compare it to, and that's when I went to Sochi, when we had, she mentioned the media center, and certainly you could see that in Sochi, they were beautifully newly built venues, including the International Broadcast Center and main press centers, and all the venues were shiny and new and beautiful, and they were something to see. In Rio, they were efficient. And they were there, and that was about it. It was not they were not beautiful, but they were workable. And they smartly used venues that they had already had built there because they had to. So you could see that. And you went to certain venues, you know, the Olympic Stadium where they did track and field was in, I believe it was in just outside of Maracanã. And it was basically an old soccer stadium, and it's not in a very good neighborhood. And so you would take the bus up there, you'd get off, you'd go right inside as fast as you could inside the security where you were safe. And then when you left, you did the same thing to get out. So there were cutbacks, and you could see it was different from other games. Again, I only have one other to compare to. But certainly we were safe. I felt safe the whole time. But there was an air of just kind of trying to make sure that you were always doing what you needed to do to be safe.
We are talking with Dave Schwartz from Care 11 this hour. We're going to be talking about Rio, your thoughts, your memories of Rio, and we're interested in hearing what you have to say. Call 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Or you can go to our live blog at nprnews.org/live and leave your question or comment. What are you going to tell your grandchildren about? What is the big thing that your takeaway from Rio?
Be thankful we live in America. And that's not an insult to Brazil. It is be thankful for the inherent freedoms that we have here, that when you walk down the street, you don't have to clutch your book bag with two hands and make sure what you're looking, you know, you're looking behind you as to who's walking around, that you don't have to worry about being out past sunset. Those are the kind of things that I took away. I'll also take away that the people of Brazil were wonderful and very nice. And I had some great conversations with people about how they feel about their country, how they felt about the Olympics. The interesting thing to me was, at least from my what I saw, was that they're unlike America, where there are, for the most part, three classes, the upper, the middle, and the lower. At least in the Rio area and surrounding, you're either wealthy or you're poor. And you either live in the nice high-rise apartments or you live in the favelas, and there's very little in between. So to me, the idea of being able to move through the class system with ease or relative ease like we can here in America, that is not as easy to do in Brazil. So when I left, I was very grateful for the fact that we live in an area where, okay, we have the freedom to do these things and to walk around and to move and to make good lives for ourselves, despite where you start.
We actually have a call here from Al in Eden Prairie, which I think gets to this point. Al, are you there?
I certainly am. Good morning. I've got a real quick question.
Morning, Al.
I haven't heard it discussed much at all of the possibility after, you know, the kind of the problems that they had, the Olympics, you know, being in kind of what was a second world and turned into almost a third world country because of the economy. If the Olympic organizers have discussed the thought of really ever having a Olympics in that type of a country again, or is it going to be pretty much, because it's been pretty much a disaster for the most part, well, not completely, but pretty tough, if it really makes sense to try going down that road again?
You know, I inwardly wondered the same thing when I left Rio, because this is now the second games for me where there is an issue with the surrounding community and how much money they were pouring into it and how that area really needed the money instead, as opposed to going towards the Olympic Games. I wonder the same thing, and how much longer they're going to be able to select these cities where it is, like you said, a third world country, or at least very close to it in Brazil. And the area around Sochi, Russia, was not particularly nice either. And we never left the Olympic ring. And if you did, you saw an area of extreme poverty. And so it made me wonder the same thing, that how much longer are they going to select these places that really cannot stand to afford these games on the guise of, well, if we have them, it'll do great things for your society after. Well, some of these countries, certainly Rio at this point, is so far down the road that there's a question is how much is this really going to help them? I wonder the same thing. I think the conversation is going to have to come up at some point where they're going to continue to put these games and how much they can really take from these countries to do it.
Thanks very much for calling in, Al. I mean, there were so many predictions of gloom and doom about the facilities weren't ready. There was the Zika threat. There was the poor ticket sales and the water quality for the open sports events. Watching, and maybe this was they were covering these things up, but things didn't seem to be that bad. It actually went, in terms of the events, it went pretty well.
It did, and it was a scaled down version. But the most important thing is, the games went off without a hitch. Everybody competed. Everybody came home safe for the most part. We actually saw very few mosquitoes, to be honest with you. And I managed, I think, at this point to come back without anything. So that's good. I just think that even though it goes, it depends on what your expectations are of the games. Are they simply just to have competition and to have pride in your nation and see the athletes play out and do extraordinary things? Or are they a spectacle to completely show off your country and try to draw more tourism and so forth? And that's what I think has to be decided. Where are the Olympic Games going, and what are the identity of the Olympic Games? I think, frankly, that it's about the sport. It's about national pride. And it has to be about safety as well. The over-extravagance with the ceremonies and that kind of thing, if that gets scaled back, I don't know that that would bother me all that much. But I'm a sports guy, and I love to watch the sports and see extraordinary, you know, normal people do extraordinary things. But I think certainly right now the Olympics are in an identity crisis as to what they want to be moving forward.
We are talking with Carol Lemsdale-Schwartz this morning about Rio. A little later in the hour, we'll be talking about the U.S. Bank Stadium. Call us with your question or comment at 651-227-6000 or toll-free at 800-242-2828. You can also get to us online at nprnews.org/live. So let's talk about the sports. I mean, you saw so many things out there, but what are they? Were the pinnacles for you? What moments are really going to stick with you?
I had a couple. Certainly watching Usain Bolt run the 200 was so impressive to me. To see someone who is so dominant at their sport, and I say that with the caveat of I tried to go watch Michael Phelps but couldn't get in because the swimming venue was so packed and it was such a high-demand ticket. And we don't always get high-demand tickets just because of our credentials. It's on a venue-to-venue basis. So we did get to go up and watch track and field. We were covering a couple of athletes, Ben Blankenship of Stillwater, Hassan Reed of Minneapolis. And it happened to be on the same night that that Usain Bolt was running the 200. And it was something I'll never forget. To hear a stadium of so many thousands of people become completely silent right before the race. And then you can actually, if you can picture 19 seconds worth of the wave of sound coming around the arena that follows Bolt. Because as he comes around in front of people, people just scream and get up and excited. And it follows him around. It was really neat. And then he runs for 19 seconds, 20 seconds. Then he spends the next half hour parading around the arena saying hi to everybody. And some people would see that as being arrogant and as being maybe cocky. But I saw it as being an entertainer. And I think that's what he does. He walks around, he takes selfies with people, and he signs autographs. And people are there to see him. He is a showstopper, and he understands that once every 4 years, it's his opportunity and his chance to try to spread who he is and give back to his fans. And so that was a really neat experience. I got to see that. There were a couple of athletes that really stuck out locally. David Plummer, the former Gopher, who missed the Olympics last time by 12/10 of a second, gets in this time, 30 years old, wins a bronze in the backstroke and is part of the gold medal relay team. So he gets to walk away with two medals, and this will more than likely be his last Olympics. And just a great guy who's really committed himself. It was a lot of fun. And that's kind of the fun for me, is the chance to get to know the athletes, and then you go and you watch them compete. And you can't help but root for them just a little bit, because it is exciting. Elise Post is another one from the St. Cloud area. She was at the Games in 2012, didn't get to make it to the finals because of a crash. Over the past 4 years, again, recommitted herself. She lost her mother a few years ago. She's been through a lot, and she got to take home the silver medal. And I got to talk to her right after, and she did the right thing and said, well, I love the silver. I really wanted the gold, but I really love the silver. And she handled it very well. And it's those stories. It's those normal people who live normal lives every 4 years, but then become complete and utter celebrities for 2 weeks. And it's just so much fun to see their excitement and be there for it and experience it. It's like nothing else to cover.
You know, it's fascinating to me that the way that narrative has become so important to these games, the story behind the event, because, I mean, there is a huge amount of work goes into preparing for these 11 seconds or whatever they are. And I sometimes wonder if we spend so much time listening to some of the narratives that we actually miss out on some of the games and the other sports.
To me, that's what helps make them so interesting. And it is, it's exceptional when you think about what these athletes do. We went to Chula Vista, California to meet with Liz Podomenik, who's from Lakeville, and she's a former Gopher. And she was training and is hoping to qualify in the discus. And every day, she does the same thing for 4 years. She wakes up, she has breakfast, she lifts weights, she throws the discus for a couple hours. She has lunch, she takes a nap, she throws the discus again, she lifts weights, she eats dinner, she goes home. That is her life for 4 years of the same thing. I don't know about you, but if I had to do that every day for 4 years, I wouldn't want to do it anymore ever again. But that's the level of commitment that these athletes put in, whether it's throwing a discus or whether it's swimming laps in a pool. It is their everything every single day, and a level of commitment that I don't think most of us have ever had to get to in our lives, regardless of what our jobs or professions are. And to me, that is what is exciting, and that is what's so wonderful about the games. It's these athletes who work so hard get their due for 2 weeks. You know, it's not a professional football player or a basketball player, hockey player, who everywhere they go all the time, they're reminded of how much of celebrity and how much of a rock star that they are. These athletes get 2 weeks for everyone to really say to them, great job, thank you for what you do, and we love watching you. And then they go back to normal life after that. And I just, that narrative has always been so interesting to me.
We've actually got a number of comments here. People are very intrigued by this whole idea about hosting. We had a call from Ali in Minneapolis, says it's not necessarily the Olympics should be held in rich countries. Many of the athletes who compete come from nations that aren't wealthy. And then we have Collins in Minneapolis. Collins, are you with us?
Yes.
Hi, what are your thoughts?
Well, I just wondered what the plausibility is of one country, let's just say Greece. Let's build a permanent Olympic facility there and hold them there every year, with each country contributing proportionally to the cost of actually the game. And then each country could bid for hosting the games, even though they're in Greece. You could have a different host every year. The facilities would remain in the same location.
That's fascinating. I mean, I immediately think the bureaucracy in that would be incredible.
Well, it would certainly be easier to keep the same venues all the time. The two things that I have with that is one, it to me, it'd be hard to pick one place that we always know will always be well off enough to always host the games. And that includes the U.S. Certainly, we don't know what's going to happen in 60 or 70 years from now. But to pick one area and say this will be the permanent host of the Olympics, let's say it's Greece. Well, they've had their problems. Let's say it's somewhere else. Everywhere has had their problems. Even we have in this country, you know, many, many years ago. And some would argue currently today. The other part of it is I think the Olympic Games are about spreading national pride and spreading that honor of having the games in your country. And for a lot of countries, it does a lot of good. we remember the last two, Russia and Brazil, and we have not necessarily seen the benefits of that. And of course, if you do a quick Google search, you can see venues from the last 20 or 30 years that have gone untouched and unused, and they're nothing.
The pictures
anymore.
Of Sarajevo.
Exactly.
Of course, they had a war there, but yeah. But still.
and what's happened, even Sochi, I've seen pictures. They made the Olympic Park into a Formula One racetrack. But there are venues there that go unused now. And that actually is a beautiful area right on the Black Sea. It's gorgeous. And there's venues that are just gone now and have not even been used. So I think, to me, while in theory I do think the idea is a good one, and obviously we're all partial here to say, well, hey, let's put it in Los Angeles or New York or Chicago, and because those places will all be fine for the next couple decades, but you just never know.
We are talking with Carol Evans, Dave Schwartz, who's recently returned from the Rio Games. If you have any thoughts or questions, call 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Coming up after the news, we're going to turn our attention to U.S. Bank Stadium and the fan reaction to that new facility. We have Guy on the line from Cumberland. Guy, what are your thoughts?
Well, I've been to four different Olympics now in four different countries, and I really enjoyed this one, not only for the landscape, the scenery of Rio, which was outstanding, but the games themselves were great. Of all the Olympics I've been to, this is the first one where the athletes were so accessible to the fans. I can't tell you how many pictures I had with athletes. Also, the spirit of the Brazilian people was outstanding. I mean, they're so friendly and so open. The Olympics are about the spirit of the world coming together, and I really saw that at Rio. We met and had our picture taken with so many people from so many different countries. That's what the Olympics are about.
You know, I have to ask you, Guy, there's a lot of people say, oh, that would be very cool to go to the Olympics, but then they're just daunted by the logistics of going to the place, trying to get the tickets. I mean, how hard was it to attend?
It wasn't difficult at all. You can buy your tickets ahead of time, although this time it might have been, and people were lined up at the venues to buy tickets, it might have been better to buy them at the venue. The only downside of the Rio Olympics was the venues were quite far apart, and you get off the metro and you had quite a ways to walk to get to the venues. But it wasn't difficult. It's not a difficult thing. I suppose if you get on a subway during rush hour, that can get a bit crowded. We had that experience once, but otherwise the subway, the BRT, and the train were quite easy to take.
Wonderful. Guy, thanks very much for calling in. Dave, what do you
say? Yeah, I agree with him 100%. And the people of Brazil were wonderful. I talked with so many people. I talked with one young man who was a student in Brazil, and he was so excited to work for the Olympics and so excited that the Olympics were there, but understood that a lot of his friends and family did not want the Olympics to be there. But he loved the idea of it, of the international experience he was getting, the ability to show off what he thought was a beautiful, what he thought, you know, believed was to be a very beautiful country. And Rio was absolutely gorgeous. It has its bad spots, but it had so much beauty. The spots in itself, Christ the Redeemer, the Celeron Steps, the Copacabana Beach, it was gorgeous. And he said that he felt like he lived in two worlds. He lived in his world where he lived and it was not a great area. And then he came to the Olympic Village and it was a wonderful area of open-mindedness and people he could have conversations with. And it was about the spirit of it. And it was the people were wonderful and welcoming. We had a couple people that we crossed that didn't particularly care that we were there, but only a few. And I think by and large, it was a very popular idea to have the Olympics there.
You talked a little earlier about national pride at being at the Olympics. And, of course, we did have the situation with the Russian team and the doping scandal that meant that there were a lot of Russians missing from that. I mean, what impact did that scandal and the whole doping issue have this time around?
You know, we heard the story and saw Lily King, the U.S. swimmer, who was very much against the Russian swimmers. And I can understand that if it goes back to all the hard work that we talked about that these athletes put in for 4 years. And you find out that someone else is doping and that they're trying to cheat where you've put in all that time. There's very much a division in the athletes that have been accused of it and or been a part of it, and the people that know that they've, or at least have said that they're very clean. So certainly it's a black eye. And that's, to me, one of the most disappointing things is that here is a games that are supposed to be good. Yes, you get a cash prize if you for winning a medal, but there's very little. This is not a big money-making thing. So then you question, well, what are you doing this for other than to try to make your country win more medals? But I think more than anything, it's just this more time than anything was a division in the athletes who were very much outspoken and against the athletes who had been doping. We've seen it in the past, but it's always other athletes don't necessarily want to talk about it. I found that this time it was much more open of a conversation.
I find it interesting, though, looking at the medal table near the end. The Russians were essentially what, fourth?
Yeah, they were way off.
Way off, but still they were fourth.
Yeah. Way off of the top three.
Yeah. But I mean, just given that they had lost so many athletes, it was still it set my head spinning. So, well, if they had actually played clean, where would they have been?
The whole time I scratched my head, and maybe it's because we live in a different world with professional sports here where there's so much more on the line, but I just kept saying to myself, why take the risk? Why risk your health? What is it for? Gold medals are wonderful, and they're a wonderful source of pride for the athletes and the countries, but is it worth doing harm to yourself to win them and to for that pride? I don't see why, but maybe I just don't understand.
We have Carol Evans, Dave Schwartz in the studio today. We're talking about the Rio Games and the lessons learned, the experiences had. We're going to break for the news in a couple of moments here, but coming after the news, we want to hear your reaction to the new U.S. Bank Stadium. We've had four events there, two concerts, two games, including yesterday's Vikings home opener. What do you think? Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Of course, you can also go to our live blog at nprnews.org/live. But let's break for a few moments and catch up on the latest headlines.
Good morning. I'm Phil Picardi from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom. Suspended Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff is telling senators she is being unjustly accused of breaking fiscal rules in her management of the federal budget. Speaking at her own impeachment trial, she said, "My conscience is clear. I did not commit a crime." Rousseff is reminding senators she was reelected in 2014 by 54 million votes. She says at every moment she has followed the Constitution and done what was best for the country. A suicide car bombing claimed by the Islamic State group in Yemen's southern city of Aden has killed at least 45 pro-government recruits. Witnesses say the men were at a staging area near two schools and a mosque when a pickup truck suddenly accelerated through the building's gate as a food delivery arrived, exploding in the crowd. Officials say more than 60 people were wounded in that attack. Kurdish-backed forces in northern Syria say they will withdraw south from their current positions in order to not put the lives of civilians in danger. The move follows attacks by Turkey-backed Syrian rebels. It's not likely to satisfy the Turks, who are demanding a full withdrawal from all areas west of the Euphrates River. A permanent ceasefire has taken effect in Colombia today between the Colombian military and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, known as the FARC. The two sides reached a peace agreement last week following 52 years of bloody combat between the government and the country's biggest rebel group. And after facing some harsh criticism over the pricing of its emergency allergy treatment, the EpiPen, the drug maker Mylan says it will start selling a cheaper generic version. It will be identical to the branded option, but it will have a list price of $300 for a two-pack, half the cost of the name brand version. Consumers and politicians have accused the company of price gouging since the list price for a pair of EpiPens has climbed repeatedly from around $94 in 2007. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 9:40.
On All Things Considered, you'll hear news and thoughtful analysis.
What's happening in a more individualistic society is we're supporting individuals and not parties, and I think that's going to make the country even more ungovernable.
I'm Tom Cran. Join me for the big stories and why they matter, weekdays starting at 3.
Support for this program comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, dedicated to promoting informed and engaged communities and committed to helping public radio advance quality journalism in the digital age. More at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Ewan Kerr, and joining me for this hour in the studio is Care 11's Dave Schwartz. Thanks for coming in today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
For the rest of the hour, we're going to be talking about the first Vikings game at the U.S. Bank Stadium. A sold-out crowd flooded in to enjoy the Vikings' victory over the San Diego Chargers. We want to hear from you and the audience who are at the game about that experience. We also want to hear from you if you're at one of the three other events at the stadium so far, the soccer game between Chelsea and AC Milan on August 3rd, the Luke Bryan concert on August 19th, or maybe you went to all four, the Metallica concert on August 20th. Call us, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Or you can go to our blog, nprnews.org/live. Now, Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sapik was at the game Sunday and filed this report.
The Vikings' 23-10 victory over the San Diego Chargers counts for absolutely nothing in terms of pro football statistics, but it does count in the annals of Twin Cities sports history. It was the first NFL game played at U.S. Bank Stadium. The building made its official debut with a European soccer match August 3rd. There was also an open house in July. But Carrie Mortrude of Cottage Grove would have none of that. A 20-year Vikings season ticket holder, she wanted her first experience at the stadium to be a football game. Mortrude says the natural light from the translucent roof and the wide concourses are a welcome change from the old Metrodome.
It didn't feel as claustrophobic as the dome, so it's nice that there's a little extra breathing room. Obviously, people don't know exactly which gate to come in, so there was a lot of, you know, heading left when they probably should have been heading right, but, you know, it's the first preseason game.
Kevin Ellich, who recently moved from the Twin Cities to Dallas, came back to see the Vikings yesterday. He also says there were some hiccups getting in, but there were plenty of staffers outside pointing the way.
They had a lot of people helping out and directing you, and it was just a little confusing. Like, we wanted to go meet some people who were tailgating in one of the lots, and like with all the streets closed off and whatnot, was a little new. You know, I mean, the logistics are, you know, a little shaky, but that'll improve as well.
3 weeks ago, many soccer fans said they had difficulty getting around inside the stadium and accessing public transit after the game was over. Things appeared to go more smoothly yesterday. As Vikings fans poured out of the doors, Metro Transit workers in fluorescent vests directed them to blue and green line trains and overflow buses.
Okay, so in order to go over to Washington, you want to take the steps up and over to get to the other side.
Other transit staffers held megaphones playing recorded announcements.
Blue line Mall of America, right. Green line St. Paul, left.
When it comes to managing the traffic flow of nearly 67,000 football fans, Michelle Kelm-Helgen, chair of the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority, says seemingly minute details matter a lot. At the soccer game, workers held up improvised signs on sticks to direct traffic. Kelm-Helgen says staff solved that problem quickly.
We added a lot more wayfinding signage, so I think people, as they enter the building, are finding it to be a lot easier to figure out, should I go right, left, up, down. I think staff have really had a lot more training and also just more experience in the building.
Kelm-Helgen says additional stanchions by the food vendors have also helped improve traffic flow. She expects staff to make additional tweaks ahead of upcoming games. One area for improvement, she says, is making sure craft beer sellers are well stocked to keep wait times to a minimum. The Minnesota Vikings host their final preseason game against the Los Angeles Rams Thursday night. The first regular season matchup at U.S. Bank Stadium will be the Vikings and Green Bay Packers on September 18th. Matt Sapik, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
So, Matt, met a lot of people who seem to be enjoying the situation. Dave Schwartz, you've been through the building a couple of times. You weren't at the game yesterday, but what are your thoughts on this new stadium?
Well, I laughed when we heard we actually had a story on our air last night about the goods and the bads of U.S. Bank Stadium, and people complained about the app not working or the Wi-Fi wasn't good enough, and you know those real first world problems that we have here at U.S. Bank Stadium. It was it's a beautiful place. I saw it without people in it. From what I've heard is navigating around at times can be a bit tricky, but I think that's usually common for any sort of new stadium. Certainly, it was not easy to get around the Metrodome either. And I heard that the volume was incredible. It was very, very loud. It's one of the going to be one of the loudest stadiums in the league, they think, at this point.
Well, we actually already have had a call in. Okay. Richard Colin said that he's really concerned about hearing damage in the new stadium, especially in the nosebleed seats. And he's wondering if he should be concerned about going out there.
Well, I'm no doctor, but I can certainly imagine. I mean, I could certainly imagine that you leave there with some ringing ears. You do that enough, it's not a good thing.
Mm-hmm. We have a bunch of calls already. We're eager, of course, to hear from people who were who experienced the game. You can call in at 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. We have David in Minneapolis. David, you have some thoughts?
Yes, I got to see the Dome Saturday night at a youth football event they put on. I'm really proud on one hand of the facility, what it does for Minneapolis, how it looks. On the other hand, I'm really disheartened by how much public money went into it. I just don't feel the NFL needs public money, and very torn and conflicted about the stadium.
Well, I think you're not alone. There's a lot of people who are wondering about that $1.1 billion spend.
Yeah, and he's got a good point. The NFL makes billions. The owners make billions. The teams make billions. Yet this stadium, they had to go into the pockets of the taxpayers. Obviously, for the people that use it, it's money that they wouldn't mind spending. But there's a lot of people that will never see the inside of U.S. Bank Stadium, either by choice or because they can't afford to go there, who still have to pay for pieces of it. So I've heard both sides of it, and I am right down the middle. I agree with both sides. It's a beautiful stadium, but at the same time, why did the local population have to pay for so much of it?
We were actually chatting before we went on the air, and I was mentioning that I was quite struck by, I watched the game on TV and was hearing the commentators talking about how the San Diego team was likely to take the experience of being in this new stadium to go back to San Diego and say, we need one of these. We need a stadium like that.
They will. And you know, as I said to you then, the NFL is one giant game of keeping up with the Joneses. And whether it's on a player level with contracts and guys wanting to be paid as much as other people at their same position, the teams also want to make sure that they have the nicest places because they want to attract players, they want to attract fans, and that's done through stadiums. And if you have an old stadium, it is hard to get good free agents to come play there, and you don't have to look any further than, say, the Buffalo Bills. Ralph Wilson Stadium is old and outdated, and it is, you know, it certainly does its job. It's got a football field and it's got seats, but other than that, it really doesn't have a whole lot of frills. And I don't know how many big time free agents are dying to go to Buffalo and play for the Bills at this point. So there is an argument that, and that's true, that if you have a good stadium, the players will want to come play there, and then you can have a winning franchise.
We have Paul on the line from Alexandria. Paul, you have a question?
Yeah, I just want to know, what does it take temperature-wise or the conditions to have the doors open up during a game?
Yeah, so we have these huge doors that people are very excited about, but the crowds can flow in, but they were not opened, at least completely, yesterday because of the weather.
That's a great question. I have not been told what the line will be, so to speak, as far as temperatures. I can tell you, if it's a conditions like it was last year in that playoff game where it was 20 below zero, I hope they have the doors closed. But I would imagine that I guess maybe if it gets below 40 or so, that they might close them above and open them, but I don't know that there's any hard line for a temperature.
I think the concern yesterday was it was such a beautiful day in many ways, but it was kept closed because of humidity, because they wanted to keep the AC on. Of course, cooling a building of that size must be quite expensive.
I'm glad I don't have to pay that bill. Yeah, they have to balance it. And everybody wants different conditions, too. You know, fans want something. Players want something different. Some players like it to be hot. Some players like it to be cold. They're more comfortable that way. So it's a balance between what everybody wants and then what they feel is best for the experience for the group.
Yeah. We had a call from Claudia in Maple Grove. She had to leave, but she said she went to the game yesterday, thought the stadium was very nice. She sat on the home side in the front of the Legacy Gate, but wishes she had brought some sunglasses or a hat to shield her from the sun because there's so much light in the stadium.
When we went for our tour, I actually got to walk on the field, and at that moment in the day, there was a line down the middle of the field from shade to light. And you could feel the difference even on the field walking. You know, it was minor degrees, but you could feel the difference from when you were in the shade to the sun, like you were actually outside. It lets in so much light. It really does feel like you're outside. And I would assume then sunglasses. I heard a lot of people were wearing sunglasses yesterday, and sunscreen is needed. The only thing you won't need is an umbrella.
And that's a plus. That's a plus. We have Kelly on the line from White Bear Lake. Kelly, you have some questions?
Yes, I do. Also, since you mentioned the San Diego Stadium issue, on the November ballot in San Diego, there is going to be a referendum. It will need two-thirds majority, so two-thirds of the people voting will need to vote yes on it for a tax increase. It's mainly tourist and hotel taxes for the city to pay their portion. The team and the NFL are supposedly going to pony up over half of the cost. But, yes, that is a big day for San Diego if they are going to get a stadium like ours or if they are going to move after this coming season. As far as our beautiful stadium, love the sunlight that is in that in U.S. Bank Stadium. And yesterday it was August, you know, it was a noon game. Sun was high in the sky. I am concerned, though, about
Were you actually at the game yesterday?
I've been in the stadium before.
Okay.
But I was not at the game yesterday. I was able to watch it on television like a lot of people. But a concern I had while watching it was that some of those late season games, December and hopefully for the playoff games in January, when, you know, the fourth quarter and maybe overtime are right around 3 o'clock, 3:15, I'm worried about the low sun angle as it'll be close to sunset at that time with the sun shining into the western end and the glass and reflecting off the downtown skyline. What will that do to a team that's driving towards that west end zone? There aren't many NFL stadiums that are orientated west-east. Most of them are north-south.
I had not even thought of that. Why?
No,
good question.
It's a good question, but the field is so much – are you – is he still with us?
Yes, I am.
Are you talking about the sun coming through the doors, the glass on the doors, or through the roof?
I'm more concerned about coming through the side the side doors when it's late in the day.
The field is, from what I saw of it, and I was down there, the field is so much farther below the level of where that sun is coming from the side. I don't, and I may be wrong, but I don't know that that's going to necessarily be right in their face at a 3 o'clock in the afternoon. But certainly it's not anything different than they would have dealt with at TCF Bank Stadium with the open end of the bank that faces downtown as well.
Mm-hmm.
So they've dealt with it before, but I wonder, you know, the logistics of where the field is and where the sunlight would come in at what angle and how and if that will actually be a problem. But that's an interesting question.
Kelly, thanks very much for the call. You know, a couple of things have struck me. We've got a message from Tessa in Minneapolis. She has a friend who uses a wheelchair, who had a very rough time, actually. She reports at the stadium. Staff didn't seem to know where to send her, and then finally they got sent to a freight elevator, which is all very cumbersome. I've been surprised at hearing some of the stories about huge lines outside the restrooms, particularly for the women's restroom, which is, everybody thought, well, that was a 20th century problem. Why are we dealing with this now? I mean, is this just teething problems, do you think? Or why wasn't this taken into account in the new design?
Yeah, I guess I would assume that it's just opening day problems, that they're still trying to work it all out. I'd actually heard someone say as well that, and some places, the men's room line was longer than the women's, and she said that was wonderful for once. But
well, I heard it was – that was at the Vikings game, but at some of the concerts, okay. It was the other way around.
Yeah. I guess I assume they're still trying to work it all out, but I'm also of the thought that if there's really not a whole lot you can do to – expedite the lines of bathrooms if they're long now, unless they're going to add more, they're going to be long 3 years from now. So that might just be one of those things that they didn't take into mm-hmm. account. Maybe all the restrooms weren't open yet. I don't know. But certainly there are growing pains and about people, you know, the lines out the door and getting in. Well, people are hopefully eventually going to be able to find their seats faster and navigate through the stadium faster once they get through. So the bottleneck, just as you get inside security, will ease up a little bit when people know where they're going. I think those kind of things will get better. Lines at the restroom, I don't know if that'll ever get better, just because that's not something that can change unless they add more.
Yeah. We've also heard people commenting on the food and beverage options and how the lines can be long at some places and also fairly expensive.
Yeah, getting your money's worth is kind of an antiquated notion when it comes to food at ballparks. I saw a picture on Twitter yesterday of someone holding up their pizza by the slice, an $8.50 slice of pizza, and it took up about a third of the box instead of the entire, you know, that wasn't exactly getting what you paid for. So hopefully, I would assume that was just a mistake, but ballpark food and that kind of things, those are expensive. And with the increasing price of stadiums, it's only getting worse. So that's just something you take into account when you go and maybe eat at home first. I don't know, or at least tailgate before you go in.
Well, I was reading in the paper today about people who they've just decided to go with the tailgating option and they've spent several hundred dollars to get a parking spot, and they'll just go to that for the game, and they'll stay outside and cook.
And they have so many different revenue streams when it comes to the NFL, whether it's the gate, whether it's merchandise sales, tailgating, parking. I don't know that, you know, if people eat less, that it won't necessarily break the bank, but I could certainly see it as an option. And I believe it was the Atlanta Falcons this year had some sort of mandate where they were lowering the prices of their concessions so that people could afford them more, because they thought it was just getting out of control, kind of as a good faith measure to the fans. So maybe that'll become a nice thing to spread around the NFL as well and lower the prices on everything. But I wouldn't hold your breath on that one.
So what is the thought nowadays about how important a new arena like this is actually for a team's performance on the field? All this money has been spent, new home, great excitement, but does it really change things for what's happening out there on the turf?
It depends on the sport, and we don't have to look very far to see Target Field. Last I checked, their stadium is pretty brand new, and their product is not looking any better. So it doesn't always translate. And the thought is that a pretty stadium, a nice stadium, will bring in, as we said before, better free agents, and then you'll put a better product on the field. It doesn't always come out to that. There are plenty of places with very nice stadiums and not very good products. The Cleveland Browns have updated their stadium over the past couple of years, and their product is always terrible. And so it doesn't always translate. But what it does mean is that it gives you hope, and it does give you one or two players that say, you know what, I want to go play there. It doesn't mean guaranteed Super Bowl, but you at least can hope that you attract a couple of guys that'll help you get there, because in the end, it's about winning. And whether you have a great stadium or not, if you're winning with the players that you're winning with, people want to come play there. And it's just one of the many, things on that resume for your franchise that will attract agents to help you, free agents to help you win. One of the hopes that maybe we'll get a Super Bowl here someday and not just hosting it.
Yeah. So fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Care 11's Dave Schwartz, thank you so much for coming today, both to talk about Rio and about the new stadium. We live in exciting times, as they say. So thank you very much, and we hope to see you again soon.
A pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.